There are potential for all of these flaws in each human, but with power hierarchies, they get magnified.
Welcome back to Business Second Opinion Podcast. We're always excited to bring you another episode. Business Second Opinion Podcast digs deep to explore questions about business and business practice. And in the process of examining them, we give you a second opinion. So you know by now, contrarian opinion, but one that's well tested and proven to give you the outcomes you want without the nasty side effects. By the way, want to learn how to work more closely with us? Stay tuned at the end of the show. I'm Zach Swartout, and with me as always is Carol Sanford, our in-house positive contrarian, responding to big and hard questions with a radically different take. Hey, Carol.
Hi, Zach. I have to tell you, I really felt sad as I read this suggested article this time. Mostly because I really felt sorry for the leaders who they're critiquing and trying to fix in here. It made me worry that this is a lot how coaches work. So if you're a coach out there, really listen to what we're talking about today. And the reason is that the theory base that they're operating from, which you and I are going to highlight, I think, a bit in our dialogue, kind of violates everything I believe about how you should design work for people, how you develop people, how you get them involved in change. I, a long time ago, found a really short, you know, they call it like your elevator speech when I'm out in the world and people say, well, what's your podcast about? I said, well, Zach and I critique Harvard Business Review one article at a time and give a better alternative. And they'd say all sorts of things like, wow, or boy, you must be smart, or is there that much wrong with what they're... Well, yeah, there's that much wrong. So what did you think? And maybe you should get people knowing what we're talking about here and what we're going to be critical of.
Sure, I got you. So this one's called Every Leader Has Flaws. Don't Let Yours Derail Your Strategy. And it's by Ron Carucci and David Lansfield. And it's actually pretty recent. It's from the September 29th issue, 2021, of good old HBR. So in it, the authors discuss how important strategy execution is. But they kind of contextualize it in saying that one of the more overlooked failures of that execution actually start in the personality flaws of the leaders calling for that strategy. So we've covered focusing on personality previously on the pod, obviously. But I think having us re-examine it through this connection to strategy might be helpful for people to see how kind of this thinking can get folks in trouble almost twice. But before I kind of pass it back over to you, Carol, I just wanted to say, you know, as you were saying before, we do get a lot of these requests and people say, how do you do this? One of the things that kind of strikes me about many of these HBR articles is they're all sourced from the same worldview. So I think Carol and I would both encourage folks to continue to read these articles on their own before sending them in and use kind of, you know, use framework thinking and use your own modes of self-reflection. I think you'll start to see the patterns in the same way that we do.
And what you're really talking about here, the reason you can see that and I can see that is we can see the same assumptions are being made that do not fit with what we are, I don't know, in every way we can trying to get you to see a developmental view of humans. And so what we're doing is pointing out the assumptions, the paradigm assumptions people are making, the assumptions about humans. And I think there are several things in this one which you will have heard versions of before, but we need to keep questioning so that we can really get a hold of it. So kind of overall, they all are talking about a way of working that's about command and control hierarchies. They're foundational to all of the flaws that are cited here. And because it's a command and control hierarchy, they never question that there's even an alternative or that that may be the primary problem that's bringing about these flaws. How do you see these flaws? And I think we should just take them one at a time and give our alternative, as my tagline says.
Yeah, totally. So to outline here first, the four personality types, flaws that they outline. So let me go through those first. So first of all, number one, the overconfident, chronically certain leader who they claim has a tendency to overpromise, develop unrealistic strategies. So that's the first one. Number two, the impulsive leader, who they say can't resist the titillation of a new idea or latest fad. Number three, the rigidly controlling leader who works and has everyone else work as they want in kind of a very prescribed way. And then number four, the insecure leader, who the authors say lives with a paralyzing sense of self-doubt. And, you know, we'll get into the nitty-gritty of each of these. But first, I actually want to ask you, Carol, what do you think, broadly speaking, is kind of missing here? And also, our listeners, keep in mind that the authors have been doing this work for a combined total, as they say, of 60 years. So even they cannot see what's missing in this approach.
Well, you know, it's funny. I just listened to you just now and thought these sound like character tours of roles for scripts in a reality TV show. All right. So let me speak to your question. I think the kind of overall thing that I see is that the real flaws are in the diagnostic process and in the solutions that they're recommending to fix it all. I already mentioned what you did too, already the top-down decision-making. Second is the idea that the top dog is responsible for the shortfalls. And of course, in a command and control, you get to boss people, but the buck stops there. Disconnect I see is that there are potential for all of these flaws in each human, but with power hierarchies, they get magnified. The third flaw is that anyone can diagnose another person from outside of that person. I can look at you, I can watch your behavior, I can add it all up, and I can give you a diagnosis, a personality type, a score. One of the problems with this concept is, as I said, the same as with coaches who will interpret or give people a test or something where just from behavioral answers, you can diagnose someone. And then, of course, the fourth one is that the solutions as well as the diagnosis are all externally determined, and the levers that go with fixing them are all external. They never start really from inside a whole human being.
And actually, to that point, Carol, I think we need to be transparent about how we're actually pulling the article itself apart so our listeners can see our thinking at work as well in terms of our diagnostic process. So let's look at each one of these aspects and how we're actually doing this. The first place where we start is we question the theory behind the diagnosis and solutions. And then we look at how each solution plays out when one uses HBR versus our philosophy of discovering what's actually going on and what we actually really want to see in the situation. And then from there, we look at better alternatives and better way than kind of their solution or effects. And then lastly, we see its larger effects in the world and kind of look at each one in parallel and why it can make such a drastic difference. And so, Carol, let's look at the first one.
Yeah, and if people use what you just laid out every time they read one of these articles, you get better and better at catching yourself, but also catching the so-called experts, like in this article, who are giving you this nonsense, like the first one, where it's overconfidence. Well, as you said, this is more like where a leader never questions themselves. The suggestions that are offered here are that you could fix this if you do something like set up some debates, and you get almost an image of the leader sitting there watching the ping pong debate. And that somehow when that happens, that gets added in to their thinking and opens them up. The problem is that additional information is not the problem that's really challenging people. Think about it for a minute. What's going on when the person watches that debate is they debate the other two people using their own attachment to what they think is really needed. If they can't learn, and you don't learn to question by watching others, you join them in the debate and reinforce your own opinion. So that's one of the problems here. The other thing is that if you're identified with a particular role, like I'm the leader, I'm supposed to make decisions, or a self-image, like I'm fast and quick and I get the right answers, And you don't learn to see that through reflection, then you're in serious trouble. They hinted the idea that you could work on seeing some things for yourself, but the fixes are all externally, add more, get people you trust, all of it's outside. So Zach, what does the HBR way look like in terms of the effects on people of this first one in the organization? And by the way, what's your experience with this?
Yeah, so I think if you look at what they're saying here, all the solutions they offer start from, as kind of Carol pointed to, an externally determined standpoint. So in other words, the leaders need external input and perspectives from others in order to be able to have them be able to them manage their personality flaws, basically. And so it puts the responsibility and agency on others to navigate around this leader and feed them back their own ideas about how that leader should behave, rather than actually the leaders start from a place of their own self-reflection and internal work.
Yeah.
And this actually fundamentally undermines a human's ability to self-observe or to be able to see their own mind at work in a more conscious way. And this is core, and it's a significant practice for internal change that is fundamentally derailed by the author's approach. And I actually saw this play out with one of the executives I worked with in healthcare. I don't know if I told the story before, but when I met him, he'd gone through so many personality tests and feedback sessions, he honestly didn't know which way was up. And while he knew he needed to work on himself, he couldn't access how to do that. It's like they gave him all this information and knowledge, but he struggled so mightily because there was a gap between the knowledge that he was tripping himself up in some way and the actual capability required to self-manage his being.
You know, I mean, that story is so familiar. And people also are taking other people's words then for what they think is really going on with them based on these testing and feedback and so forth. None of that really, as you say, helps them develop themselves. So the alternative that we want to suggest and ongoingly suggest is development of every person in your organization becomes primary. You have it happening in a ritual way, like weekly, like some in every meeting, because it takes a long time to break up this addiction we have to external and to learn to be self-observing, see what I'm thinking and doing, become self-correcting by learning to see the effects of what we're doing. Why couldn't this leader, if they were in a normal session, not pointed at him particularly, or her, him in this case, what if they could observe and say, what's the effect of that? Or pick some place and see what the effect is of your work. Where are you unhappy? Doing that on a regular basis reinstills and redevelops the capacity for people to see themselves. And the thing that also drove me crazy about this article is they call out the leaders for their flaws. My gosh, everyone has flaws in personality. Mine terrify me some days. We want to help organizations make this reflection of being able to see oneself, not particularly focusing on personality, and I don't think that's a good place to start even, but a ritual that underlies our everyday of working and gives people this ability to see themselves together. Secondly, they need a shared framework and a process for each self-examining, not other examining. This idea of learning to see the effects we produce, the process a team can use. If you have that kind of shared framework and an ongoing development process, you have a really good chance of people becoming mindful. And of course, for me, they have to be connected to the corporate direction. And we've talked before about many different ways of setting up, because if everyone's connected to the corporate direction, you don't need a leader delegating from the top down.
And I think, you know, as we kind of pull out and see the larger effects of this in the world, where instead of building spaces for our own self-reflection, we kind of end up in this place, if we follow the authors, we constantly judge people's surfaces and reduce them to a behavior of some kind, and then figure out ways to arrest that behavior, right? So you need actually look no further than like angry Twitter mobs looking to cancel people for this behavior or that behavior or what have you. And this ultimately breeds reactivity and anger, which becomes really intoxicating for people.
And we wonder why we have the society we do.
Exactly, right? And this ultimately leads to this distrust of one another that we see that's kind of infecting our society. So if we can't trust ourselves and one another, what does that say about continuing to evolve a democracy?
Wow, yeah, it's scary. All right, so let's do our second leader flaw. Here you talked about this as the impulsive leader, you know, like shiny objects, everything new, wants to be first, early adopter. Their suggestion from the author is to, you need to slow them down, create some artificially constructed gates that they have to pass through that stop the action and require things to go much slower. Again, instead of developing the human being, they've got an externally imposed process to manage the leader, manage, as you said, around the leader. I laughed when I read the thing about asking them to hand over the keys like you do a designated driver. Boy, that's a pretty low image of what leaders can do and can learn from themselves. Wow. They suggest some more things like over-indexed accounting. Now, I mean, just think about what that means. Instead of using accounting, we can make decisions with, let's make it harder to make decisions and put more gates in the way so that we can compensate for their impulsiveness. Their words, right? And help them examine what and drives that. Now, that sounds good, right? Help them examine what drives their impulsiveness. It's a reasonable idea, but the problem is at this stage, we're starting from fragmented thinking based on they have a problem, they have a flaw. Learning to look at ourselves is not a part of how we do business. It's when people have imperfections, which we do work that starts with essence, right? And then look, have people look at where the imperfections are based on their daily experience. And be able to help develop in themselves. It not only isolates a person to start with a fragment of them, a flaw, a problem, something they're not doing right, not meeting expectation. And it starts with also externally someone telling them, and we're again teaching them, don't trust your own lived experience, only trust the outsider.
Yeah, I think the metaphor of basically thinking of this impulsive leader as a drunk driver is pretty, pretty ridiculous. But so if we think about just the structure of how the authors are proposing this, right? You're starting with a set of problems. And so you're inherently limiting the possibility space of how someone can grow and what you can consider because you're isolating to these problems. And so you're left instead to only work on failings. But let's think for a second. What's actually more core than that? What's driving a human from underneath? What we call that is essence and the capability of essence thinking to be able to see the pattern behind the pattern. And starting instead from essence, for us, allows a developmental process to unfold towards what gives life rather than what arrests it.
Yeah, boy, I could take a deep breath as you said that. Mm-hmm. You know, the thing that seems... it feels almost magical to me is what we have to work from that I don't see anyone else having is a developmental technology. That means we have developed and worked with in our community for over 80 years now. You know, I mean, it didn't start with me and didn't start with the person who I got my start from. But it's working off of fundamentally different premises about how humans work, how change works, how growth and development of people and large-scale change works. Having that developmental technology allows us to see so much more powerful ideas, all of which overcome this behavioral externally fixes that I believe actually make the organizations work because if you look at what happens in this article and any, go pick any article, HBR, they're all now full of ameliorations, mitigations for all the problems that have been created by other things, like the hierarchy creates what we've got in this article. Having to do feedback gets created from the idea we have to have competencies. And people have to meet those competencies. Both of those, hierarchies and competencies, are artificially constructed ideas which come off of a non-whole, non-living systems way of thinking. A better idea here, rather than, you know, trying to ameliorate and work around, and this will help with all four of our flaws here, is to work with framework thinking. You mentioned that earlier. What does that mean? That means you have a living system framework, which takes a while to switch because we're full of old, outdated, if they were ever relevant, mental models that come off of behavioral and machine, mechanistic, and some humanist theory. If we work from shared, everyone having a shared language out of living systems, for shared framework thinking, we can together make decisions. And we can tie those decisions to corporate direction so we don't have a problem with the impulsiveness. In fact, I have to tell a story on Jeffrey Hollander. When I got to seventh generation, my gosh, that was 20 years ago now, or maybe more, Jeffrey was in trouble with his teams all the time because he was one of these folks that would have been diagnosed with impulsive decision-making. He'd meet somebody, he'd get excited, he'd come back, it was his company. He could say, we're going to go do this. We've got this great new product or new market or new technology, maybe even raw materials, communities. And it would jerk the organization and change direction. And everyone, when I first got there, everyone said, you have to fix Jeffrey. We can't run a business. And I said, well, no, actually, we have to fix the way you make decisions. And corporate direction, as we came to it, and Jeffrey knew now that he was tied to the idea the seventh generation was the voice of authenticity to help people make the decisions between personal and global come together. He now had to, when he came in, people would say, so why did you want to do that? And he'd go, and they'd say, no. How does that carry out corporate direction? Jeffrey Hollander said it was the most brilliant thing that ever happened because he improved his critical thinking skills, his personal self-management, and the ability of the organization to work together.
And I'll take a shot at another story as well. Like if I look at my relationship with my stepdaughter,
yeah,
constantly restraining her willfulness, it turns out, only makes her become more willful. I know that's a big shock to everybody, right? And a familiar story to you, Carol. But without me understanding what drives that willfulness to begin with. So while I may think that the choices she's making might be risky and impulsive, it doesn't matter if she can't see her own mind at work.
Yeah.
Right? So she's coming to an age where she needs to source her own ability to self-reflect on the choices she makes, tied to what drives her. And that capability can and will serve her in all walks of life.
Yeah, forever. Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right, well, let's take our third flawed leader. This is one you called the rigidly controlling leader. And of course, the minute I say that, you probably get a picture of micromanaging and can see that that is purely result of a power hierarchy. And that power hierarchy undermines not only all the employees, but the leader having to be saying what's the right thing to do. They even name again the suggestions here as mitigation. So you should know anytime you're mitigating, you're working against a flawed system and what it's created, and are now creating another word. And of course, these programs and their mitigations are a big part of most HR solutions. And of course, here we're coupling it with the ameliorations of all the programs and their side effects. Here, what our author suggests is a way to mitigate these controlling people is for the leader to become more transparent. Tell them what you're thinking. Tell them why you're thinking it. So people will know what's going on in your head and why you're trying to control. And that'll build trust. Well, I'm not sure because it doesn't sound like much development of thinking there. Sharing is a pretty limited idea. But they thought, well, make it low risk for them because these people are afraid. Take some low risk situations, which means slowly, creepingly work on trying to manipulate this person from the outside. Or they said, go get them to test their ideas with a few folks, maybe people they respect first. Again, we're in isolation. There's no development of systemic thinking and strategic thinking. One of the suggestions they also made was get people to go look at their own history. Well, looking at your own history, see why you're afraid and you're trying to control, is a therapeutic model. It's not a very developmental model because it's not giving you a way to understand how to assess a business thinking and business decision making in teams where you have shared frameworks. So you end up with more behavioral suggestions all from the outside. And even when they did one inside one, the solution to it, what came from the outside, was some kind of generic idea. If you are embedded in a strict command and control hierarchy, no wonder you have overly controlling and impulsiveness. It really does not give any advantage for an organization to be hierarchical, but it does limit people learning and developing and being able to come up with alternative work designs, because you're leaving a broken, flawed system in place and trying to mitigate, ameliorate around it instead of doing something new. And it isolates the leaders as the problem.
And one thing I actually wanted to point out to piggyback on that is this question we continue to come back to with ideas like this. And I think it's a useful question for you, the listener, as well, is where is the source of agency here? So in the case of examining the problem diagnosis method, the source of agency continues to live with the leader, right? This whole article is written around the leader, and as it did in the previous examples. So this is the key assumption that continues to confound the author's approach. And what gets compounded in the situation is that the leader is also the source of the work design. So nowhere in this example do they discuss customers. And I think they only bring up customers like once in the whole article. So in other words, the scope of the problem diagnosis surrounds only the leader and their staff. Nowhere do they consider and therefore allow their client to consider a larger scope that includes customers, stakeholders, and the systems in which they're nested. And the failure here is too narrow a scope of considering that starts in a thinking process.
Yeah, well said. I like that. So what should they do instead? You know, as Zach said, our way of working is to examine it. We can see it through frameworks and you can hear us talking about it. But how do you come up with a better idea? Well, we're always starting with a whole different set of premises. And one of them is that you need to adopt a developmental work design. And what does that mean? It means a non-hierarchical one. It means a non-driven by action one. By the way, you improve your cash flow by about 35 to 65% a year per annum over time. So when I'm talking about all these indirect ways of working, they do not make you make less money. You will make an enduring kind of return. But one of the big shifts when you go developmental is you no longer have a hierarchy of power and authority where people are reporting to others. Instead, you have a hierarchy of capability, a new kind of infrastructure, which takes a little while to get your mind. And it's not about getting rid of supervisors like some people think. Well, you do that and it'll all be fixed. Nope. All of those still work internal. They don't actually solve the fundamental problem that hierarchies have now embedded. What you do when you have a developmental work design is people are resources to one another in the design, and you designate people who stay in resourcing roles and work to help collectively and collaboratively initiate strategic pursuits. Those come particularly through market field teams. Those are the people where they're buyer group by buyer group, and you have people on that team for years and sometimes decades who know that buyer node so well, and you're doing strategy at a more specific level rather than this broad level where you have some kind of mission or a statement, but what you do is delegate it down from the top. No, you have to get it so it's created in the bowels of the organization and the teams. The hardest part here is to get the process that leads to a complete redesign. And it takes a little while to get that set up, but it's a different kind of infrastructure where everyone is initiating. Everyone is then implementing what they initiated, pulling others in, and everyone is evaluating what they're initiating, so it's not coming from outside. And there's tons of reflection built in and development. No one's expected or to delegate, evaluate others, lead from a top-down position. You can't have this problem. So my answer is to each of these is you have to stop what you're doing. You have to switch to a whole different work design. Stop mitigating, stop ameliorating. Those are degenerative processes that you're trying to slow down the rate at which they demean all the humans in your organization, including the leaders.
And without developmental infrastructure to build the capability to consider the larger context of decisions, we fall back into this kind of problem solution mindset. So the problem with this nature of thinking is that it fragments how we approach work. And so this ultimately leads to the isolation of variables to be solved, right? Ultimately creating unforeseen consequences, which are more problems to be solved. And we see this all the time with larger issues like climate change being tied to poverty, for example. And so without the ability to consider a larger scope that doesn't end at the walls of the company, we will continue to feel like we're plugging hole after hole in a dam that is fundamentally compromised.
So our fourth flaw here is a leader who's insecure. Ha! I rarely met a person who doesn't second guess themselves, including me. Not only are businesses high-pressure places where we're expected to please some more power or many more powerful people, but all institutions seem to be filled with these hoverers who are ready to judge you, and it's built into the system. Our own judgment is rarely accepted. We're doing something this year at the Regenerative Business Summit, which I hope all of you will send teams to, which are about looking at how we've designed work so that it produces systemic racism. It produces divisive conflict out in the culture like we see nowadays. And it blinds people to the ability to see what their own effects are on climate. If you can't see that you're actually designing systems that are undermining you, then it's very hard to work on the right thing. One aspect is that we're routinely taught and raised as we come up in life to not trust our own lived experience. That's what it means to have everything driven externally. You trust the expert who gives you the right answer, the teacher who gives you the grade and the answers, the parent who makes you a good person and tells you when you are a good boy, and a boss who tells you whether or not you're getting it right. No wonder people have insecurity. And we tend to borrow their ideas, adopt their opinions for what is right. And of course, because of all this, we want to get their approval. We feel we have to guess what they think is right. This, therefore, second guessing. This tendency then, of course, further exacerbates the problem of not trusting ourselves since, well, we in some ways don't trust anyone except the expert at the top, and they are the ones who decide whoever's on top of us. But all of these processes of not trusting ourselves exacerbate the problem for the leader and their need to be the one who figures it out and diagnose it. They often get expert hired guns to come in and help. I should at least comment on there. Although most of this is behaviorally driven, there are a few humanistic processes in there, like go examine your fears, do worse in best case scenarios, get realistic. Well, all those are lovely. We'll talk more in a moment about why that doesn't actually take you very far.
And the flaw and the solution that the authors propose here drops out a concept we discussed previously on the pod, locus of control. in the case of someone who lacks confidence, the belief that's driving that, in a sense, is that they're not in control of their life. I feel this all the time. The locus of control, therefore, lies outside of them and leaves them with a sense that everything is happening to them. I think this is something we can all identify with. This is a capability that can be worked developmentally, though. And instead, the authors propose a list of behaviors to arrest the symptom rather than working on the fundamental thinking that underlies it.
Yeah, this one's a pretty sad story here. And I personally was a little offended that they selected a woman to label as insecure. I was offended in that it's a caricature, but more because everyone's insecure. Some people have gotten better coping and hiding and, you know, managing themselves, but all of us are insecure from the top to the bottom. Everyone is externally evaluated now. Behaviorism drives culture. It drives businesses, homes, schools, and everything is proscribed as having to come from the outside. In a developmental organization, which we're talking about, you eliminate all those traditional hierarchies, not the people in them. This is not about getting rid of supervisors. You redefine, and that's a long story about what becomes their role. You stop all external evaluation. That includes performance reviews, feedback of all sorts. Instead, you have ongoing development, weekly, daily if possible, intensely monthly, not annual events where somehow you all share information and do a little training. No, it becomes a way of explicitly using living systems framework. So no one is second guessing. No one is unclear. You have infrastructure that itself gives a clear path, not your boss who's telling you what you ought to work on. You self-discover based on a new kind of infrastructure. Particularly, it's all driven by compelling and singular corporate direction, that which makes your business so important to a particular set of buyers, and you're always working to see how to make their lives richer and deeper. And off of that, then people can do shared co-creation, not waiting for delegation.
And I think the thing to keep in mind here is that external locus of control is a mindset and a worldview. Right. So when considered in the larger scope of our relationships, how we are as citizens and parents and business leaders and so on, this worldview breeds an inability to truly affect change because we believe that we have no control of our lives, let alone ourselves. However, with work, we can see when we fall into this mindset. I, as I said, find myself falling into it constantly when a customer cancels a contract or one of our vendors forgets to accomplish a task. And the work then is to reflect and choose a more developmentally contributing mindset. This is where each moment is an invitation for personal, team, customer, and systemic growth. And with the framing the authors offer, we're left with a list of behaviors to repeat instead. But with our developmental view, we can see new opportunities for innovation that open up in not only our business endeavors, but personal and societal as well.
Yeah, as a way of kind of summarizing where we are today, I want to come back to something you barely mentioned, but haven't talked about it before. But these authors have no idea about the idea of essence, which is each human being, each raw material, each place on this planet has an essence. It has its own story. It has something that is incomparable. It's not to be compared. What they're working from is the thing you can create a typology around personality, and you can create definitions of what it ought to be for everyone. And this whole article misses the idea of developing a work system that allows every individual to do expression of that, to generate and initiate, and to really bring forward their own essence experience in the world. You wouldn't have any of these problems if that's where you started from. So thank you all for joining us today. We have an upcoming annual event, which we really look forward to. We take a subject and invite people who don't work with us daily to come experience how we think about it. This year, I hinted at earlier, it's the three underpinnings of systemic racism, divisive conflict, and planetary genocide. And why in the world do those seem to keep getting worse as time goes on? We're going to look at how it is we could be starting at a very different place, just like we do here, and accelerate that transformation. It will have you working on these three issues in a way you've never thought about them before, and giving you profound ways to take it on through your work life. You go check out and sign up, if it makes sense, at carolsanfordinstitute.com. Under offerings, you'll see the Regenerative Business Summit.
By the way, have you read The Regenerative Life? Or how would you like to do one of the workshops that all those in the stories in the book did with Carol? Or maybe even take on one of the 9 roles applied to any area of your life? Well, now you can. The materials, the sessions with Carol, the Q&A sessions, it's all now a DIY workshop and virtual for free. If you want to get involved, go to carolsanford.com under books and scroll through the Regenerative Life Project and apply. You may be a guest on the upcoming Regenerative Life Hacks with Carol when you submit your story.
And that Hacks is a YouTube channel we're launching the first of the year. If you would like to get more experience with the Regenerative Life and the 9 roles or the Regenerative Business, I have a fairly extensive workbook and a book club that goes with it. In order to get involved with it and get the workbooks, which come free with the purchase of the books, you have to buy those books through my publisher. But the good news is they give you a 50% discount off the minimum 100 books it takes to get all the workbooks, all the videos, etc. And there's free shipping to almost everywhere. Go check that out under carolsanford.com under books.
And thanks as always to Numi T for sponsoring our show notes for a 3rd year in a row. And thank you to our listener for suggesting the topic. This has been Business Second Opinion.